We've gone from this. Oh, he's so cute. Oh, my gosh. I can't wait for the dance. Okay. Then we hit this. LOL. You got pics? Oh, all that texting is worrying doctors.
We decided that since we didn't want to call this an addictive disorder, we didn't want to have a psychiatric label, we came up with the name Textopathy.
Well, teens and texting addiction, it is all on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, May 26th. We're textopathic here on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in our partner studios at WGBH in Boston. And Farai Chaday is with us from New York. Good morning, Farai.
I think I have an allergy to texting. Anyway, coming up this hour, new science shows texting might be hurting teen minds and bodies. We will explain what's going on. Plus, a few states have gay marriage, but what about gay divorce? It's complicated and controversial, too. We'll explore it in a conversation. This and more ahead, but first the headlines.
And in the headlines, all eyes on California. A decision from California's Supreme Court is coming on lawsuits targeting Proposition 8, which bans same-sex marriage in the state. Californians voted it into law in November. Protests are scheduled around the state and elsewhere in the country today. North Korea has an answer to all the international criticism it's getting for nuclear weapons and missile testing. The answer is to apparently test more missiles. South Korean media reports say the North tested more short-range missiles today.
The latest launch report follows a U.S. Security Council vote opposing testing. Susan Rice is America's ambassador to the UN.
The council was unanimous in its strong condemnation and opposition to the nuclear test by North Korea. We will now get down to work on a Security Council resolution.
John Bolton had Rice's job during the Bush administration. We talked to him earlier. He says yesterday's move was all talk.
The Security Council yesterday didn't do anything.
Bolton told us he wants harsher economic sanctions against North Korea. Also, two important economic reports are coming out later this morning. We're going to get fresh data on home prices and consumer confidence.
A union is making a deal with General Motors. Auto workers in Canada have voted to accept a cost-cutting deal with the company. The union agrees to reductions in pay and benefits in exchange for guarantees that certain Canadian plants will stay open. American GM workers are scheduled to vote on their own new agreement later this week. GM has until next week to decide whether to file for bankruptcy. Fry?
And in sports, NBA's Western Conference Final is now tied. The Denver Nuggets beat the LA Lakers last night to even up the best-of-seven series at 2-2. And tonight in the Eastern Conference, the Cleveland Cavaliers visit the Orlando Magic. Orlando leads 2-1.
Asian markets lower this morning. Wall Street reopens today after a long weekend. The Dow opens at 8277. The S&P starts trading at 887. We're going to be talking later this morning about texting. It seems to be an addiction among young people. We want to know, what's your preferred method of interpersonal communication and why?
This is Henry from Boston, Massachusetts. I use the typewriter because there's a little more physical responsibility with the page.
He should be in a museum. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Your preferred interpersonal communication platform. Texting or what is it?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Farai Chaday in New York. I'm up in Boston live in the WGBH studios. Over the weekend, missile tests, nuclear tests, and the international community is trying to figure out what to do. North Korea has test-fired more missiles just hours after the UN Security Council condemned, to a certain respect, its underground nuclear tests yesterday. That's according to South Korean news reports. But what the international community is going to do remains a bit of a puzzle. Here's President Obama speaking on Sunday.
North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs pose a grave threat to the peace and security of the world, and I strongly condemn their reckless action.
Characterizations of reckless and condemnations are one thing, but actually taking action against the North Koreans is quite another. Hans Blix served as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, from 1981 to 1997. He joins us from his home in Sweden. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Blix, first of all, the leadership of the IAEA is now in transition, and I'm wondering how much the international community can do in a situation like this, where North Korea seems to be intransigent and also has a track record of getting exactly what it wants every time it raises the stakes here.
Well, I don't think the transition in the IAEA plays a very great role at this very moment. A little later on, if the six-part talks were to lead some kind of agreement, then they would need to reestablish inspection in North Korea. The IAEA inspectors were thrown out some time ago. And for an agreement, the other world would like to have resumed inspection, and the exact role of the IAEA would then be important. I don't think it would ever, the North Koreans would ever agree to something so far-reaching as we had in Iraq. But nevertheless, they must be effective.
So what are the channels to possibly have any kind of influence with North Korea? And as an observer now, not necessarily as a player, how do you rate what the U.S. has done so far? And again, let me reiterate, the North Koreans seem to have gotten exactly what they have wanted every time they raise the stakes in this way.
Well, in the past, frequently the philosophy or policy was to reward them, to give them an incentive to come along with tearing down their nuclear installations. And they did tear down a few things, but then they walked backward. And many people said, well, they are trying to sell the product twice and get paid for it several times. And I don't really see that there is very much that the U.S. or others can give North Korea now as an inducement. They have practically promised that North Korea would not be threatened by any attack from the outside or subversive actions, that they could have diplomatic relations, that they could have even a peace treaty. And they will, of course, they will get oil and energy and various other things. So I don't see that much that they can, you, I can add very many more carrots. On the other hand, if you look to punishment, then it's very risky, and everybody knows that Seoul is within artillery range from North Korea. So one has to be careful that it doesn't really break out a war. What I would like to do is to, I think, increase the pressure, the economic pressures on North Korea. And the Chinese are the ones who can do that. But the Chinese will be, have been very cautious, and they will remain cautious. They don't want to cause a collapse in North Korea, because then they would get an enormous number of refugees, and the same would happen to South Korea. So it's rather a calibrated increase of the economic pressure that can be achieved at the present time, I think.
Do you think the ability to exert that economic pressure is complicated or diminished by the, let's be frank, the debacle in Iraq over weapons inspections and the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that the sanctions were designed to, prevent a war, and in fact a war took place, all of these things, do they work against having any leverage with North Korea?
Well, in Iraq, of course, the military means failed in a way. Now we are hoping, after many years, we're looking at a better situation. But the U.S. actually promised that it would be a quick thing. They would be welcomed with flowers, etc. But instead, we got a long period of chaos and anarchy. And I think that's precisely what we would like to avoid in the case of North Korea. So I think they would be very, very reluctant to apply any increased military pressure. On the other hand, it is conceivable that the North Koreans, the leadership there, whoever it is, whether it's Kim Jong-il or the military, that they would like to increase tension or keep tension high, because that can justify their grip on the population, justify the military means. So they are not against, I think, a bit of provocation. It's very hard to maintain today, after all, that the Obama administration in the U.S. is more threatening than the Bush administration. They can't really say that sincerely. But yet they want, I think, to keep the kettle simmering and thereby to also justify and legitimize the hard grip they have on the population.
Mr. Blix, this is Farai Chidea. I want to point out an article which had a very incendiary headline. It was in Slate magazine back in 2002 as folks were talking about Iraq. And it said, Hans Blix, incompetent bureaucrat or cowardly diplomat. And it went on to ask, and, not my opinion, I'm just quoting it. It went on to ask if you were just too nice to try to deal with these kinds of issues. Where do niceties come into play? Where does a certain sense of graciousness come into play when dealing with people who are openly hostile? Is it even worth it?
Well, you sometimes in diplomacy and politics come across people whom you really don't like, but you nevertheless have to negotiate with them. I don't suggest that one should have to be nice or flattering, but I think that correctness is a useful conduct. If you try to humiliate somebody, as the U.S. talked about the axis of evil, etc., or Kim Jong-il as a pygmy, that does not increase your chances of having results in negotiations. So I think correctness, following the rules, is good. I'm not a pacifist at all, and the U.N. Charter is not based on pacifism. And what I'm discussing here is the possibility of increasing a pressure on North Korea, but not going to military action, because that, I think, would be catastrophic, and I think many other people would agree with me on that.
Just quickly, give me two traits that you have to have to be someone who's effective as part of the IAEA.
You have to have tenacity, and you also have to know the rules. What is your mandate? Not go outside them. And you have to try to keep the confidence. Even those to whom the IAEA board is directing harsh words, you have to keep the basic correctness and sticking to the rules. Even the North Koreans, as in a court, a judge in a court sees many crude criminals, but nevertheless they have to enjoy the benefit of the rules. And I think that the IAEA at the top must do the same thing.
Well, but Hans Blix, though, what are the rules? I mean, proliferation now seems to be moving on multi-channels. If we're talking about South Asia, there's proliferation there. We certainly have proliferation in Israel. What precisely is the threat of the North Koreans getting nuclear weapons? What is it? They're going to, nuke South Korea, and then they'll be totally leveled by the world community?
No, I think that's unlikely. I don't think that's what most experts would fear. But there are two that I can see. One is, if they really fulfill this line, it may provoke people in Japan, in the political life of Japan, to say that we too in this situation must have nuclear weapons. And Japan with nuclear weapons, I think, would change the strategic picture very much in the Far East, and certainly would not be liked by the Chinese. So that's one risk. And we have had some individuals in Japan have talked about nuclear weapons, but they are pretty well vaccinated and a very strong body of opinion against it. So immediately I don't see that that's a risk, but it could be. The other risk is that the North Koreans will be reckless in spreading the technology or spreading the nuclear material. 8 kilograms of plutonium is not much bigger than my fist. So it doesn't take much difficulty to export it somewhere. And then
then
customers.
That leads to a final question, and which does the international community have more weapons to control, the development of nuclear weapons on the part of North Korea or the proliferation of nuclear material should they develop it? Which is easier?
They try both. You have the Proliferation Security Initiative, which will stop ships and airplanes if they suspect that there's something on board. But with such small quantities as you have, or even drawings of centrifuges, etc., it's very hard. And Mr. Khan in Pakistan succeeded pretty well on that. Now, stopping the production of this material, and that affects the larger installations, like the reprocessing plants in Yongbyon. But they are there, and you don't know whether you have them all. It's as in the case of Iran. You don't know where they all are.
Well, those two extraordinary challenges, both for the international community and the Obama administration. Hans Blix there. He served as Director General of the IAEA from 1981 to 1997, and you'll recall was head of the UN committee that was charged with searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He joined us from Sweden. Fry?
All right. Texting. Texting.
Did you just text me, Fry?
I did. That was the sound of silence. You know what? There's so many people getting in touch with us. 16 to 60 to Methuselah. Tell us your methods of communicating. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Methuselah is not our demo.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So we'll be talking later this morning about texting. I'm Farai Chidea, and yeah, texting could be an addiction among young people. At least that's what some experts say. One listener says she is not an addict.
Hi. I'm calling to say that I'm 16 and I don't text at all. I'm from Rhode Island, and I usually use email or AOL instead. And I'm Cecily.
Okay, well, Cecily, your favorite communication method seems to be email. What about everybody else's? We want to know what your favorite method is. My favorite is face-to-face, although I'm an email addict. 877-8-MY-TAKE, tell us yours, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. One of today's big stories about the California Supreme Court and same-gender marriage. Will it be legal again in California? So there was this ballot initiative, Prop 8, which was a popular vote that banned gay marriages after it had been legal. What happens to those marriages now? You've got states like Massachusetts saying it's legal, but what happens when a gay couple decides it's the end of the road and they want a divorce? Well, things get complicated. Here to tell us why, we've got Frederick Hertz, an attorney in Oakland, California, and author of Making It Legal, a guide to same-sex marriage, domestic partnerships, and civil unions. Frederick, what's the problem that separates divorcing gay and lesbian couples from divorcing straight ones?
Well, there are three sorts of problems. One has to do with non-recognition. One has to do with the problem of having been together before marriage was legalized. And the third has to do with how the couple perceives the laws of marriage. So the first issue is the problem of non-recognition. You mentioned the states that allow marriage. Well, part of the problem is that we've got couples who, because they couldn't be fully married everywhere, tried to be half married in as many places as they could. We also have couples who move around. So you have the couple that marries in Massachusetts and moves to California. The couple that lives in California went to Vermont for the weekend or went to Vancouver and got married. When these couples break up, they're going to find themselves sometimes in states that don't allow them to get a divorce because, in a perverted sense, a divorce is a form of recognition. And in other states, there are real questions as to what happens to the kids born, the money earned, the debts accrued, because the courts can't figure out, and sometimes the couples themselves can't figure out, well, in the state that we live in now where we're getting divorced, are we married?
Wow, that's a lot. In some ways, I'm jumping ahead of the game a bit, but could you solve some of this by doing extensive prenups, or is this...
You can solve most of the problems. For example, you can't determine parentage by agreement. So, in fact, we recommend in California that even when people get married or are domestically partnered, they still do a second parent adoption, so they actually have a court order showing whose kid the kid is, in case they travel or deal with the federal government. The issues of money and property, those can all be dealt with private agreements. However, in order to do a private agreement, you have to actually conceive that you might break up, which is something that actually neither straight nor same-sex couples seem to do a very good job in anticipating.
Yeah, who wants to do that? So, Frederick, if we look broadly at divorce law, Is divorce law any indication of how seriously courts take same-sex unions? You said perversely that if a divorce is recognized, it kind of, by implication, recognizes a marriage. But if courts are very serious about dividing resources and income and assets, that sort of thing, it by implication means they're taking seriously the idea of a same-sex union, correct?
Well, not only is the court taking it seriously, the couple is as well. One of the sort of secrets of marital law is that as long as the couple is together, you know, nobody other than the couple pays much attention to their life, and oftentimes the couple itself doesn't pay that much attention. Where the laws of marriage come into play is, frankly, when the couple breaks up, or if, I must say.
Well, Prop 8, I lived in California until recently, and I have met many people who have been married, and then they thought they were unmarried, so they'd go and get remarried again. And, you know, it's just the most bizarre situation that's unlike any place in the country, including places where same-gender marriage was legalized. When you take a look at this, do any true life stories come to mind for you?
Well, yes. And in fact, one of the lines I give now is that there's a new form of discrimination against gay people. It's called discrimination in the form of legal complexity. So here's an example of a case I'm consulting on. A couple last year, a long-term couple, gets legally married. Now, they don't also state register, which they could have done in California, but they don't, because now domestic partnership, which once had a sense of victory, now has the stigma of the second-class status. So they don't domestically partner. And then they break up. Now, whether it's the pressure of marriage, whether it's just the culmination of 20 years, whether it was the marriage was the last attempt, I'm not sure. Now they have broken up. Well, the problem is we don't know whether California will give them a legal dissolution of their marriage. Had they state registered as domestic partners, we know we could get them a dissolution. We don't know if we can get them a dissolution. And until this couple can get a dissolution, the one who now has a new partner can't repartner with that person. We don't know whether that person is still going to be eligible for health insurance with the old partnership. And the money that they accumulated in this 8 months, which actually was not so significant because this couple actually accumulated debts, we don't know, and they don't know whether that, those debts and assets are joint or separate.
Well, that's Frederick Hertz, expert based in Oakland, California, author of the forthcoming Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage. And now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. In just a little while, President Obama is planning to announce his pick to replace Justice Souter on the Supreme Court. Now, this news comes according to several officials. The president is widely expected to nail a woman to the High Court. And in fact, we're getting some news in from the Associated Press that the president intends to nominate Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor as the first Hispanic to serve on the Supreme Court. Sotomayor would succeed the retiring Justice David Souter if confirmed by the Senate. And the official spoke to Associated Press on condition of anonymity because the president has, of course, not yet announced his decision. Meanwhile, the president has condemned North Korea for launching an underground nuclear test. And there are reports today that North Korea continues to test its short-range missiles, even after international outcries against the tests. The UN Security Council is drafting a resolution to punish North Korea. In international news, the Supreme Court in Pakistan lifted a ban that stopped the opposition leader and former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif from running for office. It clears the way for Sharif to contest national elections in Pakistan. And that is a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning for I.
Thanks so much, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Farai Chidea. I'm in Boston. Farai is in New York. Joining us now is Nate Persily, professor at Columbia Law School, to talk about a story that seems to be coming into focus this morning. For weeks, we've known that David Souter is retiring from the Supreme Court. And while it could end up like a Palin surprise, there are various reports, both from the Associated Press and CNN, suggesting that the nominee to be officially announced later this morning by Barack Obama to replace David Souter will be Sonia Sotomayor, a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit since 1998. Nate Persily, friend of the program, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The fact that, let's just assume for the moment that Sotomayor is the pick, what criteria does she satisfy at this point as you look at this nominee?
Well, you know, President Obama did say that he wanted a justice whose background suggested that he or she would be empathetic to the concerns of the litigants before him or her, and Sotomayor was the one that a lot of people thought might fit that bill. She, you know, grew up, literally pulled herself up by her own bootstraps, growing up in the South Bronx, was first in her class at Princeton, then went to Yale Law School, worked in government as an assistant U.S. attorney, was actually appointed by the first President Bush to the district court, and then was elevated to the Second Circuit by President Clinton. I think she does obviously fulfill certain demographic and diversity criteria that a lot of people thought might be a factor in the decision. And I think that the right wing was, in some respects, fearful that she might be the nominee.
Well, Sotomayor, as you say, she would be the first Hispanic to be on the court if she is confirmed and if indeed she is the nominee. Many people in both the sort of legal world and in places like Columbia Law School have been suggesting that what Obama really needs to do is to have someone on the court who is both a progressive and also an intellectual able to debate the likes of, Scalia and the others on the court who are, you know, intellectual heavyweights. Does she satisfy that?
Well, I think, to some extent, let me criticize my colleagues in this. I think there's been a whispering campaign against Sotomayor, which has been incredibly unfair. She is as good as most Supreme Court justices. She has been on her court for a long time. She's been a judge, a qualified judge, for a very long time. And whether she is the liberal version of Justice Scalia, I don't know. I tend to doubt it. There are very few people like that out there, and many of those types probably are not confirmable. So the fact that President Obama did not appoint sort of a firebrand liberal law professor, which was what many suggested, is not terribly surprising. But remember, this is the first of maybe three picks that President Obama is going to have. And so he's thinking long term and how he's going to put the pieces together. And I think, you know, he's looking at the next pick as maybe being the one that might satisfy the liberal intelligentsia as opposed to maybe getting, in some ways, a typical justice.
Liberal intelligentsia. You know who you are out there. Quickly, is there any disappointment that this is another person from the circuit, from the federal appeals court, that really keeps the Supreme Court looking very much like a kind of a upgrade from the federal circuit?
Well, there were some people who thought that Diane Wood was going to be the nominee. I actually thought Diane Wood was going to be the nominee. She does fit the bill of what you're suggesting, which is that she's a law professor who also has been a judge and is seen as incredibly, you know, a real intellectual heavyweight to maybe balance out Scalia and others. But maybe she'll be the next pick. And I think that he wanted to break new ground with Judge Sotomayor. He's doing so. I think this will be a very energetic confirmation hearing. There's going to be a lot that people are going to throw at her, and a lot of people will be paying attention to it.
Nate, I have a couple things for you. First of all, do we know of any deal breakers that could derail her confirmation hearings? Think about Bork, et cetera. It's never a sure thing to be a nominee. Anything on the horizon?
Well, I think that this is going to be more of an ideological fight than a personal one. I think that, say with Justice Thomas or with then-Judge Ginsburg, who bowed out, that, you know, these ethical improprieties come up sometimes and are people throw the senators throw it at the nominee to see what will stick. I don't think people think that's in her past, but there are some opinions that she's written that a lot of people are certainly going to point to as being left of center, but elections have consequences. So the fact that President Obama has picked someone who is likely to be, say, pro-choice and reflecting the positions of most of the liberals on the court is not terribly surprising.
But what about decisions, though? Are there particular decisions that are going to be looked at in the confirmation hearings?
There will be. There will be all of her decisions are going to be looked at. I mean, and in particular, a case that's before the Supreme Court right now called the Ritchie case, R-I-C-C-I, which dealt with whether is basically an affirmative action case with a special twist as to whether whites sort of were victimized by a decision not to apply a test neutrally to all applicants for a fire department post in New Haven. She not only sided in a direction that the conservatives on the court are probably going to overturn, but also she did it in a summary opinion, which I think people are going to say reflects, a certain non-seriousness in dealing with serious constitutional or statutory issues.
Well, when you take a look at these potential three slots that President Obama may have to fill, that's an incredible boon for a president. You have a Latina who could become the next Supreme Court justice. Is he going to use these identity litmus tests, do you think, if he gets a couple more shots at this?
To some extent, having Sotomayor go first prevents him from having to do so later on. But I think, President Obama wants to break new ground. I mean, this is a historic moment, appointing the first Latino woman to the Supreme Court. Who knows who might be next? I mean, I think in some ways that Sotomayor, despite these demographic groundbreakers, is a conventional pick, someone who comes from the circuit court, who's been a judge for a long time. I'm at least one of those people who thinks that we have too many judges on the court, that we ought to have the history of having politicians be Supreme Court justices, people who've actually been in the rough and tumble of politics. And I think that we should not be surprised if he does that with the next pick, for example.
A different kind of diversity. Again, Nate Persily from Columbia Law School, our friend here on The Takeaway, with some minutiae there about the court. There is a Ginsburg on the court. You're referring to the Ginsburg who pulled out for using marijuana back in the 80s. Great obscurity there, Nate Persily. Again, Sonia Sotomayor is apparently going to be the nominee when Barack Obama announces later this morning his pick to replace David Souter. Thank you, Nate. And Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thanks very much, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. California's highest court rules today on whether the gay marriage initiative Proposition 8 is legal. The voter initiative banned gay marriage through a constitutional amendment in November. Now, if the court rules in favor of Proposition 8, it will have to decide whether to invalidate the estimated 18,000 same-sex marriages already performed in California during the 6 months that the marriage was legal. And finally, in Iraq, three Americans died in a roadside bomb attack west of Baghdad, and the deaths included a soldier, State Department officials, and a civilian contractor. That is a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry up at WGBH in Boston. So the North Koreans have conducted an underground nuclear test over the weekend, and then this morning they test-fired more missiles. The UN Security Council has condemned them. The Obama administration has called the North Koreans reckless. Where do these governments go for some intel on what's going on in North Korea? Well, they probably call Curtis Melvin. Curtis, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
He's an economics PhD candidate at George Mason University and has developed a map of North Korea that's like no other. First of all, Curtis, why are you so interested in North Korea? And if I were to go to you, what could I find out about this most isolated and mysterious of countries?
Well, North Korea doesn't receive as many Western tourists or visitors as many other countries in the world, and it sounds like a really fun place based on the news you receive on a day-to-day basis. But I had the pleasure of visiting in 2004 and 2005, and I began mapping out the travel route that I took in the country, and then the curiosity got the better of me, and I just kept going. And so for the last 2 years, I've been mapping out North Korea's military and economic infrastructure using Google Earth technology.
And using this technology, what could I find out if I was, say, a member of the Obama administration or the United Nations Security Council? And who of those institutions has actually contacted you, if any?
The program is that I've developed in collaboration with others who are also interested in discovering about North Korea is a very comprehensive program. We've scoured just about every existing map and book. We've interviewed people who have lived there. We've interviewed people who visit. North Korea receives cultural delegations, tourists, business investors, and NGO workers and aid workers, and every one of these people has their own experience with North Korea, and we've been able to capture that disparate information so we can show things as mundane as a new duck farm built on the riverbanks of the Taedong River in Pyongyang, or the Pyongyang chewing gum factory. But we're also able to capture some more significant things, such as the elite compounds where North Korea's politically privileged class lives.
Right.
And also, unfortunately, we've also been able to see the devastation of famine by locating what are essentially mass graves, and also been able to locate what human rights activists say are the notorious gulags.
Well, Curtis, I want to remind our listeners that they can go to our website and link to your map. And again, you're at George Mason University in Northern Virginia, right?
Yes, sir.
And according to the latest intel, the range of the missiles, nuclear tipped or not, in North Korea is about 1,500 miles, right?
That's correct. They're last.
So you're out of range at this point. Are you worried about dear leader taking any sort of action against you?
I have gotten a lot of jokes about this. I actually would like to return to North Korea in 2012, which is the 100th birthday of the founding leader of President Kim Il-sung, and they're supposed to be having some amazing visual displays.
Well, Curtis, we hope you get the chance to do that, and I'm sure you'll take a digital camera if you do. Curtis Melvin, economics PhD candidate at George Mason University, with perhaps the best interactive map of North Korea in existence. Thanks, Curtis.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea in with John Hockenberry, and we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Farai. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is expected to announce his Supreme Court pick later this morning. Sources say that Sonia Sotomayor is the choice, and she's currently a U.S. Circuit Court judge. Now, if confirmed in the Senate, she'd be the first Hispanic to serve on the nation's highest court. Justice David Souter is stepping down, and we will be discussing his potential replacement in just a couple of minutes. So stay with us here on The Takeaway. Reports out about South Korea say that North Korea has tested more short-range missiles. This move comes in the wake of widespread international condemnation of yesterday's nuclear weapon and missile test announcements. President Obama led the way.
North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs pose a grave threat to the peace and security of the world, and I strongly condemn their reckless action.
There's talk of new sanctions against North Korea, but disagreement on what to do. North Korea is already under long-time sanctions. In international news, a famed democratic activist testifies today in Myanmar. Aung San Suu Kyi told the court today that she didn't think she violated the terms of her house arrest by offering temporary shelter to an uninvited visitor. Military rulers have kept her under arrest for years, and Suu Kyi's lawyers say that the new charges are just an excuse for the generals to keep her in prison. Auto workers in Canada have voted to accept a cost-cutting deal with GM. The union agrees to cuts in pay and benefits in exchange for guarantees that certain Canadian plants will stay open. American GM workers are scheduled to vote on their own new agreement later this week, and GM has until next week to decide whether to file for bankruptcy. And that's a look at stories making news nationally and internationally. For I, John.
Thanks,
Femi.
Thanks
so much, Femi. So we're going to go right into the top story there that Femi had. First of all, so much for diversity. Another vacancy on the Supreme Court, and it appears another federal judge will be appointed. Let's get you up to date on the details. Administration officials who spoke anonymously to the Associated Press say President Obama has settled on his pick for the Supreme Court. He's scheduled an announcement for 10:15 this morning at the White House. Sonia Sotomayor, a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Southern New York, is the nominee, is the reported nominee. Dahlia Lithwick joins us now, chief legal correspondent for Slate.com. So much for diversity in the sense that it's another judge if Sonia Sotomayor turns out to be the nominee. But what diversity does this nominee bring to the court, Dahlia?
A whole lot of diversity. I mean, I think this is really, if rumors are true, and it proves to be the first in the U.S. Supreme Court, I think it will be an extraordinary day for America. And then again, just the third woman ever to be on the Supreme Court. I don't know that Obama really could have picked someone who didn't come off the federal bench. He really has said all along he wants someone with a very robust constitutional vision. It's just awfully hard to find that in a Jennifer Granholm. As much as she, you know, is an impressive candidate on the merits, you really needed someone who's thought about the Constitution for 20 years. And those people tend to be federal judges.
All right, let's talk about that constitutional vision. Can you sketch it out for us and use as many opinions and decisions in your answer as you possibly can to help us out here?
Well, I think that, you know, having looked at her opinions and where she's come from, you're going to hear a lot in the coming weeks that she's a radical liberal activist. The truth of it is, I mean, as is the case with anyone who's been on the bench for a long time, she certainly got some opinions in which she was reversed by the Supreme Court. One of the most controversial opinions you're going to hear about in the coming weeks is this New Haven affirmative action case, where it's a sort of a reverse affirmative action case where New Haven firefighters are claiming that they were discriminated against because they were white, and the city scuttled the results of a test that all the firefighters took in order to gain promotion because no African Americans placed high enough to be promoted. It's an incredibly controversial case, and she sided with the city of New Haven, saying it was okay that they scuttled the results of the test. That's going to be, I think, one of the cases, this Ricci case that is now currently actually on appeal before the U.S. Supreme Court, looked from oral argument as though that case was going to be reversed, like she was going to be reversed. So I think so far as I think these confirmations tend to sort of pick one or two cases and caricature them, what you're going to hear about the Ricci case, she's a mad fan of affirmative action, even when it hurts white men, and that the Supreme Court smacked her back for that. Of course, it'll be much more complicated. But I think, really, all in all, if you look at her, certainly she's on the liberal end of the sort of normal spectrum, but I think that she's probably no more radically liberal than the David Souter she's replacing.
One thing that strikes me on the big picture is that you saw, you know, one reason that many people have for voting and that others don't pay attention to is the Supreme Court. And you have seen in the past 9 years these incredible opportunities to reshape the court. What do you think that someone like Sotomayor, I mean, I'm assuming it will be her, but if she doesn't get confirmed, for example, but what would someone like her or her do to the balance of the court?
Well, that's really the key question, and it's the one that frames everything that's about to happen in the coming months. I mean, let's remember, Obama has the opportunity to replace a moderate liberal with a moderate liberal. So the net shift on the court is going to be not at all. You're still going to have a 4-4 court with Anthony Kennedy in the middle, but usually voting with the conservatives. So you're right. The net effect is actually not all that consequential. I think the effect of this particular choice has less to do with the balance of the court and reshaping American jurisprudence for decades, and much more to do with the fact that Obama really, it was important to him, and he said this over and over, wanted to put a sort of real person on the court, genuine, you know, this is a woman who grew up in the housing projects in the shadow of Yankee Stadium. Her dad died when she was just a kid. She was brought up by a single mom. She was, you know, really born to just tremendous poverty. Her parents were immigrants, and she's a first-generation Latina. So there's this amazingly compelling personal narrative that's sort of reminiscent of the Clarence Thomas story, someone who, you know, then ended up graduating summa cum laude from Princeton and, you know, at Yale Law School and So I think that's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, she brings an amazing personal narrative. 5 years as a prosecutor with the Manhattan District, editor of the Yale Law Journal. She's a diabetic, diagnosed since the age of 8. I mean, she's got a broad sort of history of kind of real America that she brings to the court, in addition to being a legal scholar.
That's right, and that's, you know, I think that's why, you know, looping back to your initial point, that it looks as though, oh my God, she's just another federal appeals court judge, but she is a dramatically different-looking federal appeals court judge. And I think in light of Obama's complaints and the sort of growing national sense that the Supreme Court is kind of made up of a bunch of sort of country clubby white men, all of whom went to the same schools, all of whom worked in the executive branch, you know, just the sense that the court is so out of touch with what it is to be a real American. I think she's a real tonic to the sense that the Supreme Court is out of touch, because nobody is going to dispute that she came from there. Now, I will say that said, she has made some very, very controversial comments about that, and in fact has sort of said that maybe it's Hispanic judges reach better results once in a while. And she's been no shrinking violet about the identity politics piece of this. So stay tuned for that to sort of blow up as a small sort of mini issue in the coming week.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, let's give a cheat sheet to people who are going to be thinking about this all day. You've already mentioned the Ricci case. That's the New Haven affirmative action case that you talked about. So people should be looking for that in the headlines. What other cases, and use them by name if you can, should we be looking for?
Well, she's heroically said to have solved the baseball strike in 1995. So people should be definitely looking for that. I think that's one example of one case. And then tell folks to also look up Malesko, M-A-L-E-S-K-O. Those are, I think, the sorts of things that if you want to get a sense of where her head is at, how she solved the baseball strike or resolved the baseball strike, Ricci, Malesko. And I think that the other thing really that people should be looking at and thinking
quickly,
at
Dahlia,
is the idea that this is a dramatic, historic day.
All right. Well, great information. If it turns out to be true, we've got lots to think about. If it doesn't turn out to be true, we'll have lots more to think about. Dahlia Lithwick, chief legal correspondent for Slate.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thanks, John. Sotomayor, we are taking a look at her. Anyway, we also are taking a look at our takeaway, which comes from the West Coast.
The issues of money and property, those can all be dealt with private agreements. However, in order to do a private agreement, you have to actually conceive that you might break up, which is something that actually neither straight nor same-sex couples seem to do a very good job in anticipating.
That's Frederick Hertz, attorney and mediator in Oakland, California, talking about problems of same-sex divorce. A California court decision on Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage, comes in today. And if you've missed anything, we're always online. Go to thetakeaway.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast there or through iTunes.
Well, if Sonia Sotomayor is the nominee, she'll probably be asked about same-sex marriage at her confirmation hearing. More on all of that later on this morning. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
So first there were primitive humans, and then somehow a mysterious mutant really changed everything.
We're always broiling and grilling and baking and barbecuing chickens, but what's ever happened to the roast chicken? Here, there's this beautiful, great, big, perfect type of...
Julia Child may have saved PBS two generations ago, but cooking saved the human race about 2 million years ago. How are we feeling about that?
We're roasting Miss Chicken.
We know how the chickens are feeling. We're cooking on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I cook, therefore I am. It's Tuesday, May 26th. Evolution in cooking, we're talking about that today. I'm in our partner studios at WGBH in Boston, and Farai Chidea is with us from New York. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. Coming up this hour, how to get your money's worth in health care. Also, layoffs from an ethical standpoint. All this and more ahead, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, President Obama is about to make one of his biggest hires. He's expected to announce his Supreme Court pick later this morning. Sources say Sonia Sotomayor is the choice. She's currently a U.S. Circuit judge. If confirmed in the Senate, she'd be the first Hispanic to serve on the nation's highest court. Justice David Souter is stepping down. Souter is a reliable member of the court's liberal wing. The gay marriage issue may someday make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. For now, the spotlight is on California's highest court today. A decision is expected on lawsuits targeting Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage in the state. Californians voted it into law last November. Protests are scheduled around the state and elsewhere in the country today. Farai?
International criticism of nuclear weapons testing is fierce, and North Korea's response is apparently to launch more missiles. South Korean media reports say the North tested more short-range missiles today. That latest move follows a UN Security Council condemnation of Pyongyang's test announcement yesterday. There's talk of new sanctions against North Korea. The nation is already one of the most heavily punished and isolated on the earth. A union is making a deal with General Motors. Auto workers in Canada voted to accept a cost-cutting deal with the company. The union agrees to reductions in pay and benefits in exchange for guarantees that certain Canadian plants will stay open. American GM workers are scheduled to vote on their own new agreement later this week. GM has until next week to decide whether to file for bankruptcy.
As if it has a choice. Well, we'll wait and see. There's news of American deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, three Americans died in a roadside bomb attack west of Baghdad. The deaths included a soldier, State Department official, and a civilian contractor. Farai?
In Afghanistan, three American troops died in a suicide bombing attack. It happened in the country's east. Three civilians also died. Others were wounded. Suicide attacks have spiked by 25% early this year.
In sports, the NBA's Western Conference Final now tied. Denver Nuggets beat the L.A. Lakers last night. Kobe couldn't do it to even up the best-of-seven series at 2-2. Orlando leads the other series over the Cleveland Cavaliers 2-1. Asian markets lower this morning. Wall Street reopens today after a long weekend. The S&P starts trading at 8.87. The Dow opens at 82.77. We're going to be talking about the ethics of layoffs later on in the morning. They may be bad for the economy, bad even for companies. They cut costs, but are they ethical? Do companies have a social obligation, an ethical obligation to keep workers on? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry with Farai Chidea. Is it a game of chicken or a game of international high-stakes nuclear poker? North Korea has test-fired more missiles hours after the United Nations Security Council condemned its underground nuclear tests yesterday. The condemnation came yesterday. The nuclear test came over the weekend. This all according to South Korean news reports. South Korea, of course, following the situation very, very closely in North Korea. Here's Barack Obama talking about North Korea when he was in Prague back at the beginning of April.
Now is the time for a strong international response, and North Korea must know that the path to security and respect will never come through threats and illegal weapons.
Yet it's been an uninterrupted path of threats and illegal weapons from North Korea. Here's the president speaking yesterday.
Russia and China, as well as our traditional allies of South Korea and Japan, have all come to the same conclusion. North Korea will not find security and respect through threats and illegal weapons.
Yet Pyongyang certainly has our attention at the White House and here in the newsroom at The Takeaway. Joining us now is Ambassador John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations. He served as the permanent U.S. ambassador to the United Nations from August 2005 till December 2006. He's currently a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. Ambassador Bolton, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So what tools does the Obama administration have against North Korea that you did or didn't have when you were in the post as UN ambassador?
Well, if I may, first, I think it's important to correct something that that you mentioned earlier and that other news media have reported this morning, and that is that the Security Council condemned North Korea yesterday. They did not. The Security Council took no action yesterday. They had a brief meeting where each of the ambassadors said that North Korea's launch or test of the nuclear device violated an earlier resolution passed after the first nuclear test in October 2006. They then agreed to work on a resolution. So the idea that they had a meeting and then, like a fire brigade at work, decided to wait to do something till the next day is exactly the kind of international diplomatic response that North Korea has been counting on, and the respect for which they showed again today by launching two more missiles. So
well,
I think
except,
you have to start this understanding by clearly recognizing that the Security Council yesterday didn't do anything.
All right, but you would describe this as a green light then to North Korea, the rhetoric from Russia and China?
Well, I think if you look back at the rhetoric from Russia and China after the nuclear tests in October of 2006 and after earlier missile tests, it was not praiseworthy of North Korea. Then when you get into the real negotiation, not talking, but what the Security Council is going to do, that you find out whether or not China and Russia are prepared to carry through on this.
But, John Bolton, doesn't North Korea have the United States and the international community over a barrel under almost any circumstances? Sanctions are at a peak. I mean, short of an actual invasion.
Not at a peak.
So, again, I go back to the first question. What are the tools? What are the tools?
My point to you is you clearly don't understand what the state of play is. The sanctions that were imposed after the first nuclear test in October of 06 were primarily military sanctions, and they're quite limited. The next step really ought to be the kind of sweeping economic sanctions that were imposed on Iraq after it invaded Kuwait in 1990. That would be a real sign. Now, whether that's going to happen or not is an open question. As of right now, no draft resolution is even on the table.
So you're saying there are many more sanctions that can be applied, many more ways of making North Korea even more isolated, tools that weren't even used under the Bush administration.
That's exactly right, if China, Russia, and others will go along with it. And that's why it's important, indeed critical, to distinguish between what people are saying and what they're actually doing in New York. You'll recall the words of former U.N. ambassador during the Johnson administration, Arthur Goldberg, who said diplomats always approach crises with an open mouth.
All right. Understood. Would you support unilateral U.S. actions against North Korea in this particular regard?
Yes, absolutely. The administration should put North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. We never should have took them off. We should resume our efforts to exclude North Korea from international financial markets, which the Bush administration started with the Banco Delta Asia matter, but then gave up on losing a big opportunity there. And I think most important, the United States should apply its persuasive power to China, which alone has the power, I think, to make fundamental changes in North Korea's behavior. China supplies 80 to 90% of North Korea's energy, supplies a substantial amount of North Korea's food. It could change that regime if it wanted to.
Ambassador Bolton, would you support changing our configuration militarily in the DMZ?
I don't think we need to do that. I don't think it's a question of military action, although I do think that we in South Korea have to be prepared in the case of instability in North Korea, Kim Jong-il dying or some evidence of unrest, to take steps to try and stabilize North Korea and prevent its nuclear weapons from falling into the wrong hands.
This is Farai. I just had one quick question on a broader level. You know that there are two American journalists who are actually in North Korea under indictment right now. One of them is Laura Ling, who is the sister of the journalist Lisa Ling, and there was a big vigil here in the U.S. about it. But the question is, What kind of firsthand reporting do we have? There are a lot of speculations about leadership in the region, et cetera. But when U.S. journalists can't get in, how much information do we have about what North Korean politics are like, how people are faring, people who have in the past been dealing with famines? Are we going on a lack of information when we talk about North Korea?
Well, I think there's a substantial lack of information about the internal politics of North Korea, and that's why I think the endless speculation about whether his son or his brother-in-law is going to succeed Kim Jong-il is a little beside the point. But you want to know something about the regime we're dealing with, starting from a common base in 1945 at the end of World War II. In fact, much of the industry of the Korean Peninsula was in North Korea. After the division of the peninsula in 1945 until today, the average height of the average North Korean citizen is 3 to 6 inches shorter than the average South Korean. That's the kind of regime they run in North Korea. They've got a people who, for many years now, have been on the verge of starvation. The one thing that regime cares about is keeping itself in power. That's what these nuclear weapons are for. They are not going to be negotiated out of those nuclear weapons. So when the president called yesterday to get North Korea back to the six-party talks, they must have been chuckling in Pyongyang.
All right, but they're also chuckling if they think that there's any pressure that's going to come from China. It seems like China and South Korea are willing to kind of let the nuclear proliferation to the north, let it live.
Well, I think South Korea made a major decision today announcing that it now, in fact, would join the American-led Proliferation Security Initiative. This is something started in the Bush administration in its first term. Under prior South Korean governments, they had declined to join with us in the Proliferation Security Initiative, and I think their decision to join today is a very significant step forward. And as for China, if they're serious about stopping the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, North Korea is the perfect test. And if, in fact, they don't want to step up pressure on North Korea, then we'll surely see it in the Security Council over the next several days.
Ambassador Bolton, can I ask you about Vice President Cheney, if I might?
Sure.
What do you make of him creating this debate, sort of mano a mano, with the president over national security and the detainees at Gitmo? Do you think it's responsible?
I don't think he created a debate. You know, I'm with the American
Enterprise
Institute.
We
scheduled the speech that Vice President Cheney gave long before President Obama scheduled his speech. But what's wrong with you? What's wrong with debate?
No, nothing's wrong with debate. Do you think
it's not mano a mano? This is about policy. You know, as long as the news media keeps trying to turn this into an ad hominem thing,
I think it's doing
an injustice to your listeners who have
Vice President Cheney didn't speak to the nation even remotely as much as he's done in the last.
He was vice president. He had an obligation to hew to the president's line, and he gave a lot of speeches when he was vice president.
So if there's a terrorist attack, what will Vice President Cheney say then?
I don't know.
Well, the question is, do you think this is a responsible debate?
Ask the vice president.
But do you think that he's correct?
Of course.
Of course. Of course.
That's what I said, right?
No more elaboration.
Well, you asked me if he was correct. I'll answer a different way. Yes, I think he's correct and very articulate.
All right. Senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And as you said, you scheduled that address by Vice President Cheney. He's currently a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Ambassador John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Farai Chidea. It seems as though it's possible, I suppose, there could be a Sarah Palin surprise. But at 10:15 this morning, it's being widely reported that the Sonia Sotomayor, who's been a judge of the United States Circuit Court of Appeals since 1998, will be nominated by President Obama to replace Justice David Souter. At 10:15, that's the announcement. The nominee, Sonia Sotomayor, only being attributed to anonymous sources at this point, but it's widely reported, and Adam Liptak, indeed, is reporting it the same way that we are. He's a Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, and joins us by phone. Adam, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So this is a combination of a very compelling personal story Sonia Sotomayor has, and also a robust constitutional vision. What does she bring to the court, in your view, Adam?
Well, first of all, she's a fairly bold pick of the available choices. She's probably the most liberal and the one with the broadest, most expansive view of the work the court can do under the Constitution. She's relatively young, 54. She's a woman, as we expected. She's Hispanic. And she will hit a lot of the buttons that the president has been talking about in terms of what he wants for a Supreme Court pick, someone who's a respected judge, but also someone who, in his words, has empathy in some sense of what ordinary people have gone through. And her own life story, which is an authentic rags-to-riches story, certainly reflects that.
Jeff, we've seen some spectacular nominations gone awry, or ones where the nominee was actually very much confirmed. I'm thinking of Clarence Thomas here, but was someone who had to walk over coals to do it, and then some of his supporters regretted it. Who is going to lead the charge against Sotomayor?
Well, it's Jeff Sessions is the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, and he's likely to be the point person on all of this. On the other hand, the president has 59 or 60 votes in the Senate, and that's going to give him a lot of wind at his back. It's also, most people would acknowledge, the president's prerogative to pick somebody. It's the consequence of winning an election, and there needs to be a pretty good case made against the nominee before there's really any significant chance of the nominee getting voted down.
Do you think the confirmation hearing will be a debate on her constitutional vision, or more about the question of is she too liberal? Do we have too many liberals? I mean, she replaces David Souter, who was widely believed to be a liberal, so her net effect on the court isn't likely to be huge.
Right. I'm not sure those two questions are all that different, her constitutional vision and whether she's too liberal. The one is kind of a code word for the other. It's a way of talking about the results the court is likely to reach. But certainly these confirmation hearings are always a moment when people focus on the court in a way they don't ordinarily focus on it.
When you take a look at this this view of the Supreme Court as a sort of rainbow coalition, which some people think is great and some people don't. You know, many people have argued that the reason Clarence Thomas is on the Supreme Court at all is precisely because he's black, and that you did see a form of affirmative action, and that the backlash against him being so small from the black community, at least at first, at least until he started making rulings, was because there was this need to have a black justice. Is there going to be a discussion of, you know, what's needed in terms of diversity on the court from perhaps a more legal framework? I mean, whether or not diversity is a goal that really should be used as a litmus test?
Well, let me flip the question around a little bit. If you look at the court and see eight men and one woman on it, you might be sympathetic to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's point of view that it just doesn't look right, that there's something wrong with a society which is 50-50 men and women, where we only have a single woman on the court. And there is a school of thought that diversity in the sense of bringing various viewpoints and various backgrounds to questions will result in better outcomes if more points of view are represented at the conferences where the justices discuss the cases.
Well, certainly in the background department, I'm looking at the New York Times right now. She brings an amazing, compelling story. I mean, okay, academically, summa cum laude from Princeton. She was 5 years as a prosecutor in the Manhattan District, but she grew up in the Bronx, diagnosed with diabetes at the age of 8. Her father was a factory worker. Her mother was a nurse at a methadone clinic. I mean, she really brings a sense of, you know, reality to the court that belies her academic credentials, don't you think, Adam?
It does strike you as a very nice combination, doesn't it? Someone who has real-world experience with the sorts of people that most of the justices, Clarence Thomas excepted, have never really gotten to know, and also first-rate academic credentials. Clarence Thomas also went to Yale Law School, as it happens.
Inspired, according to the New York Times, by the Perry Mason series she watched as a child. That's a good one. I hope she's asked about that at the confirmation hearings.
That's good. Yeah, we got to look into that.
I mean, if I can just play that theme again, I'll be happy. Is there a particular case that the confirmation hearing is going to focus on, do you think, or that the coverage is going to focus on?
Yeah, we have an unusual situation now where one of her cases is before the Supreme Court as we speak. It has not decided yet, but it seemed to indicate some hostility to her reasoning. The case involves a reverse discrimination employment claim by white firefighters in New Haven. And it's at least possible the Supreme Court will reverse her, and it's at least possible the Supreme Court will be critical in the weeks to come of someone whose nomination is pending.
This is the Ricci case, and
That's right.
If she's not going to be seated until next term, this could be decided this term, and she could be looking at this case as soon as she sits down.
It will be decided in June. But what we'll have is the current Supreme Court, you know, passing judgment on the work of a likely future member of the court, and judging from the argument, it's likely to be critical of her work.
All right. Well, Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, talking about the apparent nomination of Sonia Sotomayor, a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, to be the replacement for David Souter. And Femi Okeh has the headline.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Just getting this news in, home prices have fallen 19% in the first quarter of 2009. The S&P's Case-Shiller Home Price Index reports that home prices posted the sharpest rate of decline since the index started keeping track, and that was 21 years ago. The UN Security Council is drafting a proposal to sanction North Korea for launching its second nuclear test in 3 years. The former US ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, told us a little bit earlier on this morning that the international community hasn't taken a hard enough stance.
I think you have to start this understanding by clearly recognizing that the Security Council yesterday didn't do anything.
Bolton said that the Council needs to pass sweeping economic sanctions. And finally, in international news, members of the Canadian Auto Workers Union have approved a deal with GM to cut wages. Has to look at some of the stories making headlines this morning. Farai.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Farai Chidea. Joining us now is Jeff Zeleny from our partner, The New York Times. He joins us from Washington, where he is reporting that within the hour, officially, Barack Obama will nominate Judge Sonia Sotomayor of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit as his first appointment to the Supreme Court. An announcement is scheduled for 10:15 a.m. at the White House. This could be, the confirmation hearing could be, the most important drama between the Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. Jeff Zeleny, what are the politics of this nomination, and how do you see it playing out? We're close to 60 votes on the Democratic side, so it may be no contest.
If there's ever a time for a president to appoint someone who he wants to appoint, someone who may be a little bit more liberal than some in the Senate would like, who may have some other outstanding issues. This is the time. President Obama has will have a 59 votes, 59 Democrats, perhaps 60 if the Minnesota Senate case ever gets decided. And this is a time when the White House really believes that they can make an appointment like this. Judge Sotomayor is Hispanic, of course, as we know. And this will make it a little more difficult for Republicans to oppose on the face of it. One of the problems that the Republican Party is facing is its outreach to Hispanic voters. And it'll be a little bit more difficult to criticize this judge on the face of that. Look, there is going to be a tough confirmation fight. It's what groups on the left and the right live for, are these Supreme Court fights. It fires up their base. So over the next 2 months or so, there will be a fight. But it would be hard to imagine, unless something comes out in the hearings, that she would not be confirmed.
Well, let's just get this straight then. You see Barack Obama, by naming Sotomayor, as really taking full advantage of the opportunity he has here to get somebody who's really progressive, who some might say is on a liberal fringe.
No question. I mean, she's not as liberal as some of the liberal groups would like, of course. But, some of her rulings are far more liberal than the other three finalists. And President Obama made a phone call to a judge, Sotomayor, last night about 9 o'clock. He called his other three finalists shortly after that. And of those other three finalists, she is certainly the most liberal-leaning or left-leaning. And we're going to hear from him at 10:15 this morning when he explains his rationale. But look for the president to focus on her life story, where she grew up, how her story is part of the American dream, much like his was when he was running for president. So her power of her biography will certainly be mentioned, and it will be mentioned that she was appointed to the bench by President George H.W. Bush. So she was appointed by a Republican. It'll make it a little bit more difficult to nail him.
That'll nail him for sure.
Well, I was just looking over. There's this great resource from the Library of Congress where they have transcriptions of a lot of the confirmation hearings and the votes on different Supreme Court justices. And in one of them, there's a phrase, and this is for Justice Roberts: "Please remember there are 280 million Americans. Be a Chief Justice for all of us." Now, a phrase like that indicates that there is partisan difference, but that there can, that it can be transcended in the course of the court. Do we get a sense right now that, regardless of the Democratic majority, that partisan differences can be overcome when it comes to something like the Supreme Court?
I don't think all the partisan differences will be overcome, but I would be surprised if at the end of this there is a party line vote, split Democrats and Republicans on this. I really think unless something comes out in the confirmation hearings, which is always possible, that's the point of these confirmation hearings. This is a lifetime appointment. So if something comes up, there could be a closer vote, but I would be really surprised if this became a deeply, deeply partisan issue. Of course, on the edge it will be, but the final vote I would think would be a mix of Democrats and Republicans voting to confirm her. Not all Republicans, of course, but I think at least some.
Very important to watch both in committee, whether it's a party line vote, and in the broad Senate when this goes to the floor. Finally, how does her biography, aside from being a compelling story for a news event at 10:15, how does that reflect, do you think, her constitutional vision?
Well, we'll find out how it reflects her constitutional vision on the Supreme Court. But look, she was born in the Bronx. Her father was a factory worker. One of the things that President Obama said he wants was someone with some life experience, someone with some different kinds of experience on the court. So, as we've seen certainly with Justice Souter, you never know how someone is going to vote once they're on the court and their tenure expands. But there's no question that her life experience is something that was very important in President Obama's selection of her today.
If I'm a baseball owner, am I worried this morning?
We'll see about that. She'll probably have other things on her plate, but
right. Well, she ended the baseball strike in the 90s. Right, exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So, finally, do you know who's going to lead the charge in the Senate? Anyone that you would think of? Jeff Sessions was mentioned by your colleague, Adam Liptak.
Well, he certainly is the ranking Republican member of the Judiciary Committee, so he will lead the charge, you know, along with Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader. And also, I'm interested to see how a senator like Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, a very senior member of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, how they react to this, what their signals are at the beginning. But the Republicans so far, my inbox does not have any reaction from Republican senators, of course, so they're on their Memorial Day recess still. But in 12 hours or so, we'll begin to see what their opposition is going to be like. But for now, at least today, this is the first time we will see and hear from Judge Sotomayor. And then she sort of steps into the ritual of largely being silent as she goes to visit all the senators on the Hill. So watch what she says today. It's the first time we'll hear from her, the only time we'll hear from her until her confirmation hearing, which could be sometime in July.
Well, that's great. I love the fact that Jeff Zeleny's inbox is empty at this point. That's a great thing to watch. The Republicans are working on a response. This will be a political battle as well as a debate over a vision of the Constitution. Jeff Zeleny from our partner, The New York Times, joined us by phone from Washington to talk about Sonia Sotomayor, the apparent nominee to replace Justice Souter on the Supreme Court. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. California's highest court rules today on whether the gay marriage initiative Proposition 8 is legal. The voter initiative banned gay marriage through a constitutional amendment in November. The president says that the underground nuclear tests launched by North Korea yesterday are deplorable.
North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs pose a grave threat to the peace and security of the world, and I strongly condemn their reckless action.
There are reports today that North Korea continued its short-range missile tests, and that comes as the United Nations Security Council drafts a resolution with more teeth than the one it wrote back in 2006 after North Korea's first nuclear test. In sports tonight, in the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals, the Cleveland Cavaliers head to Orlando, where the Magic lead the series 2-1. But off the court, the Cavaliers are working another team. The Cavaliers say that they've agreed to sell a 15% stake in their franchise to a group of Chinese investors. And just to recap our lead story this hour, President Obama is expected to announce his pick to replace Justice Souter on the Supreme Court. Associated Press is reporting the president will tap Judge Sonia Sotomayor as the first Hispanic to serve on the Supreme Court. Let's look at your top stories for now. Farai.
Thanks so much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea.
Guard Lewis playing off the ball. Lewis gets it to LeBron for three for the win. Yes! LeBron James at the buzzer!
That was LeBron James's buzzer beater again at the Magic, against the Magic the other night. We're wondering how it would sound in Mandarin? That's right.
Meow.
Mandarin Chinese. The Cleveland Cavaliers, in the midst of a playoff series against the Orlando Magic, agreed over the weekend to sell 15% stake in its franchise to Chinese investors. This is the first major investment by the Chinese in a major American sports team. And with us now is one of our favorite sports dudes, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, or it's Matten. We discussed
Mateen.
I love this. I'm trying to get all Frenchy, but it's not working. You're the sports blogger based in Brooklyn and New York, and we love having you on. So what's the deal? Why is China investing in U.S. sports?
Well, definitely because part of the reason, Yao Ming, of course. The average Chinese fan wants to see the King and Mr. Ming paired up to take the NBA title, and I think that's what the future vision is.
Do Chinese folks, I mean, you know, obviously Yao Ming is huge, but is this sport huge in China?
It's definitely huge. They said there was something like 12 magazines related to the NBA in China. I think it's only going to get bigger. Yao Ming is a huge star, but not only Kobe is a huge star over there. The NBA is a growing market, and China is definitely the future of the NBA's money pool.
What about endorsements, which are such a big part of the sport?
In what sense?
Well, we heard that there's basically a couple of shoe companies, which kind of surprised me, Li Ning and Anta, signing deals with folks including Shaquille O'Neal, who you could argue has kind of passed his glory days. But when you have shoe companies in China investing in black men in the U.S., is there also like this cultural transference factor, like you've seen in Japan, a lot of frankly, worshipfulness of black hip-hop culture?
Definitely. I think, LeBron has said that he wants to become the first sports star to make a billion. He wants to become a global sports icon. He wants to be like a Pele or like a Muhammad Ali. The only way you're going to do that is to dip into the market that has the most money.
The only way to do that is to beat the Orlando Magic.
And that is definitely the case. So I think that speaks actually to a whole nother piece. For the average Cleveland fan, you want to get this is good business because then they can actually put in the money that's going to get LeBron to stay and help them to build a championship team around them, even if it doesn't happen this year.
Well, you know, when I look at this, and usually you and John are doing most of the chatting because I'm not always the 100% sports person, but to me, this is really a story about aspiration on some level. It's about what we dream to be. And why do you think that being a basketball star, having the basketball Jones, translates as a vision of achievement?
I think that there's a escapist piece of it. They do things that we wish that we could do. And so we look to them as almost as if they're royalty. That's why we call them King James. That's why we know Yao Ming by his one name.
Well, on that note, King James, how about King Ibrahim? Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports blogger based in Brooklyn, New York, friend of our show. Thanks for coming in and talking about China's investment, Chinese investors taking a 15% stake in the Cavaliers.
They're going to need to do it.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea in with John Hockenberry. First, we have Femi Oke with the headlines. Hey, Femi.
Thank you very much. Good morning. All the time is almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is expected to announce his pick this morning to replace Justice Souter on the Supreme Court. Now, officials have told the Associated Press that the president will tap Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor as the first Hispanic to serve on the Supreme Court. New reports say that North Korea has followed up its nuclear weapons testing yesterday with more short-range missile tests. This comes in the wake of widespread international criticism, including condemnation from the UN Security Council. John Bolton was the American ambassador to the United Nations during the Bush administration. Earlier on The Takeaway, he told us that the UN needs to go much further and punish Pyongyang.
The next step really ought to be the kind of sweeping economic sanctions that were imposed on Iraq after it invaded Kuwait in 1990. That would be a real sign.
The United Nations Security Council says that it is starting a new resolution on North Korea. Auto workers in Canada have voted to accept a cost-cutting deal with GM. The union agrees to reductions in pay and benefits in exchange for guarantees that certain Canadian plants will stay open. And finally, to France now. The belongings of the French mime artist Marcel Marceau are up for auction in Paris today. More than 900 personal possessions are to be sold to pay off some of the debts he'd run up by the time of his death in 2007. Marceau's daughter, Camille Marceau, describes what's going on sale.
What's incredible is that effectively it's everything. All his collection. There are the photos of all his acts and performances, his stage costumes, including his battered old top hat he wore as bit.
So, Marcel's belongings will be on sale today.
How much for those tights, Demi?
They're actually going, I'm glad you asked that, John. They're actually going for really bargain basement prices because the judge has made, well, used as well, but used but washed. But the judge has made the auction take place to pay off the estate's debts. So a lot of French artists are complaining that some great French history is going for bargain basement prices. I'll bid on the tights if you like, John.
All the mime news here on The Takeaway. Thank you so much, Femi.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That's great. A big news morning in about 15 minutes or so. We're going to learn officially from President Obama who his pick for the Supreme Court is. It's reported to be Sonia Sotomayor, a judge in the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit right here in New York City. I'm John Hockenberry with Faraj today, and we go live now to the Q20 bus, where Jenny Rivera joins us, professor of law at City University of New York Law School. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
You clerked for Judge Sotomayor. What's the one thing I, as an American citizen, need to know about her as I contemplate her on the Supreme Court?
She is a fair jurist. She is brilliant. She adheres to the president, and she's got this really incredible background that she brings to the court. And we should all be pleased that the president has made a wise choice.
Now, you're perhaps the best person to ask this. Do you think she wants this job, Jenny Rivera?
I think she wants this job, and I'm happy she wants this job. It's a big commitment. It's not an easy thing to do, to have your life sort of open for the scrutiny. But she wants the job.
All right. Jenny Rivera is a professor of law at the City University of New York Law School. She's joining us live on her way to work at New York Law School. Dahlia Lithwick also joins us.
She's City
University School of Law. Thank you. Dahlia Lithwick also joins us, chief legal correspondent for Slate.com. She's on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia. Recap for us what this appointment means. Jeff Zeleny of The New York Times said, it appears that Barack Obama is taking full advantage of his majority, possible supermajority in the Senate, to make a very liberal appointment here. Do you agree?
I don't think very liberal is fair. I think certainly she's on the liberal end of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and she will be on the liberal end of the U.S. Supreme Court. But really watch for language like that in the coming weeks. She's going to be characterized as a radical liberal activist. And, you know, there are hundreds of opinions that she's written over the years, and I think folks should sit down and grapple with those opinions. These are not the writings of a deranged liberal activist. This is someone who's very close to David Souter, who she'll be replacing on the court as a sort of middle-of-the-road, moderate liberal who actually, in case after case that I'm looking at this morning, made a pretty temperate, reasonable decision rather than a sort of deranged, lefty activist decision.
Well, Dahlia, I'm going to come back to you in one second, but Jenny, I want to ask you, you are the director of an entire center on Latino and Latina rights and equality. And what do you think are some of the, there's been a lot of talk about Voting Rights Act and a lot of other cases that the Supreme Court has considered that are very much about racial equality. What do you think that Sotomayor brings to the table as someone who has personal experience as well as professional experience in looking at race in America?
Well, first of all, I think my colleague now on the phone who just commented is right. You're going to find sort of a moderate person who's in the mainstream. And so I think you're going to see that on. But with your question with respect to sort of the background of the jurist, that is certainly important. We have to remember that all those judges on the Supreme Court, the justices, are all humans. They do bring an experience. You know, she brings that experience as a person who grew up in humble beginnings, was raised by her mother, grew up at a time when there weren't as many Latinos who were members of the bar. There weren't that many women who were doing the work that she was doing. And so she brings that deep understanding with her. And she's also, and people will see this, I think, in her opinions, you know, she combs through the record, she looks for what's in the record, and she looks at the whole record to come to a just decision. So she's going to bring that to the table, and she's also been a trial judge and a litigator, both in the private sector as well as a prosecutor. So I think she's also well aware, and people don't talk about this, I think she's also well aware of the impact of these decisions on actually bringing cases. She has that understanding as a first.
Right. Well, we're going to know more about that when Barack Obama actually makes the announcement in about 20 minutes. Now, to both of you, and Jenny, why don't you answer first? You're on the bus there. We might lose you, and we'll go to Dahlia if we have to. But who do you think Sotomayor is going to tangle with on the court based on any of your experiences, either looking at opinions or, in your case, Jenny, clerking with her? Who do you think she's going to tangle with?
Who do I think she's going to tangle with? Well, I think she's going to end up being sort of in that middle, at least, as has already been commented. And, you know, for anyone who writes an opinion that doesn't seem to adhere to the law, that seems to be a mischaracterization of the law, that doesn't really take a fair and just look at the facts, I think she will respond to that in her writing.
Dahlia, is it Scalia, is it Alito, or Roberts, do you think, that are more likely to be her antagonists?
Well, I mean, I think she brings to the bench a very different perspective, and you look at her civil rights cases, you look at her cases on a variety of issues. She's probably not going to agree with them, but I think it's probably not accurate to say that she's going to tangle with them. Certainly, with a handful of exceptions, she's a pretty temperate writer. She is not one to excoriate people in her dissent or to try to make the other side look stupid. That's just not her style. So I think that what you're going to see actually is a very different way of talking about the law than we've become accustomed on the court. I think some of that sharp elbows and sharp tongues hopefully will actually be diminished rather than, I think, exacerbated.
Well, we've got much more to talk about, but we're going to leave it there. Dahlia Lithwick, chief legal correspondent for Slate.com from Charlottesville, Virginia. And Jenny Rivera, thanks so much for allowing us to be with you on your commute this morning.
Thank you.
Jenny Rivera, professor of law at City University of New York School of Law. She clerked for Judge Sonia Sotomayor in the Southern District of New York in 1993. Again, within the hour, President Obama will announce Sonia Sotomayor to replace David Souter on the Supreme Court. Farai?
Well, if you missed anything, we are always on. And hey, what an amazing day. At thetakeaway.org, you can subscribe to our podcast there. And your takeaway is another voice chiming in on the court.
If you look at the court and see eight men and one woman on it, you might be sympathetic to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's point of view that it just doesn't look right, that there's something wrong with a society which is 50-50 men and women, where we only have a single woman on the court.
That's Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. And I think identity politics, John, are going to be a big part of this. You know, some people will argue it's irrelevant. Some people will argue that it's critical.
Well, we'll hear it from her later on this morning. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.